From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. House Democrats say they will issue a subpoena to a key witness who was blocked by the Trump administration from testifying today in the impeachment inquiry. The U.S. ambassador to the EU, Gordon Sondland, was directed not to show up because the president said the process was unfair to Republicans. House Intelligence Chair Democrat Adam Schiff had this to say this morning.
We will consider this act today, and we've had members fly in from around the country to hear the ambassador's testimony, as well as the withholding of the ambassador's documents, to be further acts of obstruction of a co-equal branch of government.
So why is Gordon Sondland so important to the impeachment inquiry? Let's ask David Herzenhorn, who's chief Brussels correspondent for Politico. Hi, David.
Great to be with you.
So if you've read some of the text messages that were released, you'll see that there are a number of messages to and from Gordon Sondland regarding the Ukrainian president and President Trump's request for an investigation into Joe and Hunter Biden, including one exchange in which Bill Taylor, who's the acting U.S. ambassador in Kiev, texted Sondland, "I think it's crazy to withhold security assistance for help with the political campaign." And Sondland wrote back, "The president has been crystal clear, no quid pro quos of any kind." But then he went on to say they should stop texting. What more do we know about why he wrote that text?
Well, there's no question that State Department officials were becoming increasingly alarmed as word was developing that, in fact, this security aid may have been held up. But Sondland's role in Ukraine goes back quite a bit further. He was there in Kiev, the Ukrainian capital, with Kurt Volker, who was the State Department's special representative for the Ukraine conflict, the day after President Trump's phone call with President Zelensky of Ukraine. That's obviously the center of this impeachment investigation. What was said during that phone call? Did the president at that point pressure the Ukrainians to investigate Joe Biden's son and Joe Biden, obviously Trump's political rival, and what in fact was happening before and after that? And Sondland can be key on all fronts. Sondland has said that he spoke with President Trump directly an hour before that phone call. He spoke to him again afterwards. He was again in Ukraine the day after that phone call, talking to the Ukrainians, depending on who you believe, either helping them to navigate the requests that were being made by Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, or perhaps in some sort of other damage control given the unfolding events there.
Well, and then on August 9th, there was a text message in which Sondland said the president really wanted a deliverable. What, do we know what he meant by that?
So what we understand from text messages that have been turned over to congressional investigators by Kurt Volker, there was an effort underway to draft a statement that would have been issued by the Ukrainian president committing in some way to an investigation of the Bidens, as well as to looking into, once again, allegations that somehow there was a Ukraine connection to meddling in the 2016 U.S. presidential election. Those allegations have been thoroughly debunked by investigators in Washington. However, Trump has seemed to latch onto that. And so it seems there was some that deliverable was, in fact, that statement, which was never issued by the Ukrainians, never made by President Zelensky, never came to be. But that seems to be what he was talking about there.
Who is this guy, Gordon Sondland? We know that he's a hotel magnate from the Pacific Northwest. He was a big supporter of President Trump's inaugural committee, donated $1 million. How did he end up as ambassador to the EU?
Well, Sondland is a longtime Republican donor and bundler, not just a donor himself, but someone who's gone out and done fundraising for Republican candidates for quite some time. He's got a very compelling personal story. His family, his parents, both survivors of Nazi Germany, escaping, then meeting up again after the war. Now, Sondland at the same time is an insider with the Trump family. He has really inserted himself, built a relationship with Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law. He has worked to expand his portfolio beyond the EU, Brussels, where he's based here as ambassador to the EU. And among those special assignments, as he's called them, is this work that he was apparently doing in Ukraine.
Now, he says he wants to testify and that the Trump administration stopped him from doing so. Do you think we'll hear from him?
At some point, we imagine that congressional investigators will not let this rest until they've heard from Gordon Sondland. Now, the president has tweeted that he thinks Sondland will exonerate him in some way, but obviously simultaneously refusing to allow Sondland to testify suggests that there is something to hide. It's very hard to explain away what appear to be the bare facts of that phone conversation with Zelensky, in which the president, of course, was asking him to do a favor and investigate his political rival, Joe Biden, and Joe Biden's son.
That is David Herzenhorn, who's chief Brussels correspondent for Politico. David, thank you.
Sure.
Well, the Trump administration is also on the defensive today after the president's unilateral decision to withdraw U.S. troops from northeastern Syria. Even some Republicans are saying that will open the door for Turkey to strike its longtime foe, the Kurds, who've been longtime U.S. allies in the fight against ISIS. Today, the president tweeted, "In no way have we abandoned the Kurds, who are special people and wonderful fighters." Najmuddin Karim is president of the Washington Kurdish Institute. He's also running to be governor again of the disputed Kurdish region in Iraq. He was ousted by the Iraqis. He joins us now from Erbil in the semi-autonomous Kurdistan. Najmuddin, welcome back.
Thank you.
And your thoughts when you heard about the president's move to remove U.S. troops from the Turkish border after a phone call with the president of Turkey?
Well, unfortunately, each time the president talks to a president of Turkey, something bad comes out of it. The last time, of course, was December of 2018, when the president, without consulting his national security team, decided to withdraw the troops, U.S. troops, who numbered about 2,000 at the time, from Syria. Fortunately, after that, he was convinced that it's not in the interest of the United States, and it will also open the door for genocide and demographic changes, which Turkey has been trying to do after Kobani was liberated, and especially after liberation of Raqqa and other places.
These were ISIS strongholds that the Kurdish fighters helped liberate.
Yes. The Syrian Democratic Forces, which is composed of Kurds and Arabs, majority are Kurds, lost 11,000 people. Mm. And the Americans, during all that time, have lost four people. Mm. And our adversaries in Syria will be the beneficiary of U.S. withdrawal, in addition to betraying the people who fought and who were the forces on the ground to fight ISIS and dismantle their headquarters and other places.
You are supported in your thinking by Republicans like Lindsey Graham and others. The president is getting a lot of pushback. Do you think he will change course as he did last time? But also, you know, explain why it matters. He makes the point there aren't that many U.S. troops, but is there a symbolism here that you think is maybe even more important?
I think, first of all, the pushback from the Congress and others have been really overwhelming, and I hope the president will listen. And the number of troops, we're talking about less than 1,000 now in Syria. This is a small number which has given the U.S. great victory, actually, in the fight against ISIS. And it is important for them to stay there, because Turkey does not dare to attack that area if U.S. troops are there. They know what the consequences are.
Look, Najmuddin, the Kurdish fighters in Syria fighting ISIS have stunned the world, men and women who have done what other forces haven't been able to do in tamping down ISIS. I'm going to ask you a question. I know the answer to it, but do you have any sympathy, though, for Turkey, which worries that the Kurds in Syria are part of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, that has been waging the insurgency in Turkey?
Well, you know, I think, no, I don't, because not a single operation has been carried out against Turkey from the forces that are controlling north and northeast of Syria now. As far as the PKK issue is concerned, there are parliamentarians who participated in the elections. They have been elected by the people, mayors who have been elected by the people, and immediately Erdogan changes them, puts them in jail. That's why people join the PKK. As long as this continues, I think PKK will be there. And even if PKK disappears, something else will come similar to the PKK, as long as the Kurds are being oppressed.
As I said, I figured what your answer might be. But what about where you are in Iraq? Are Kurds there nervous as well that the U.S. might be pulling out of Syria? Is there a sense of the U.S. abandoning all Kurds?
Well, unfortunately, the Kurds have bitter experience in the past, not necessarily with this administration. It has happened in 1975. It happened in 1991. So it has happened many times before.
Let's be clear. When the Kurds were fighting for independence and thought they had the U.S. on their side, Saddam Hussein gassed the Kurds, and the U.S. didn't respond. I mean, it sounds like that's what you're saying, that the U.S. has let down the Kurds before.
Yes, absolutely. And actually, that was in 1988 when chemical weapons were used on Halabja. And at that time, some U.S. officials tried to blame Iran for using the chemical weapons in Halabja. And we all knew that it was Saddam Hussein and his troops that did that.
Najmuddin Karim, president and founder of the nonprofit Washington Kurdish Institute, speaking to us from Erbil in Kurdistan and Iraq. Najmuddin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, one of the hosts of On Point, the NPR show that takes you behind the headlines. We've done a deep dive series on education, and all episodes are available to binge now. Listen to On Point now on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
You may be in possession of a batter-stained, dog-eared copy of How to Cook Everything by Mark Bittman. Well, this month you can get a reboot of this Bible of the Kitchen, a special 20th anniversary upgrade of How to Cook Everything, this time with charts and pictures. So that's how you prepare shrimp, or DP a pod, or bone a chicken breast. Look at the list of things you can toss into pasta, and how great. A focus on sustainability and flexibility, which of course means... well, we're not quite sure. So let's ask Mark Bittman. He wrote for decades about food for the New York Times, became the first food-focused op-ed columnist. His 2007 TED Talk has had more than 4 million views. He's currently teaching at Columbia and joins us from NPR's New York studios. Mark, welcome back.
Great to be here, Robin.
Well, you know, when this first happened in the 1990s, people made fun of you. You know, like, how to cook everything, that's impossible. But, you know, oh, here's a picture, I'll just open anywhere. Here's an outline of a pig with the major cuts of pork. Here's, turning the page, 21 main course bean dishes, the basics of tofu. Turn another page. Here's breaded and fried eggplant or any vegetable. Give us some overarching tenets about cooking simply and sustainably.
Well, the simple thing, you know, of the things you just read, I think about that eggplant headline, which is how to cook breaded eggplant or any vegetable. And the fact is, once you can bread and fry any vegetable, you can basically bread and fry all vegetables. I mean, you might need a little tweaking here and there, and we offer that. But it's not like you need to relearn each individual food and each individual technique every time you cook. That once you have the fundamentals down, everything else is kind of a variation. So that's flexibility. And I like to think over the years I've learned how to better and better transmit that information about how simple cooking is and how the way to cook is to go find good ingredients and not screw them up and so on. Mm-hmm. Sustainability is not something we really talked about 20 years ago, right, and certainly not 40, 50 years ago. But now it's obviously an issue. And when you talk about meat eating, for example, it's not just a question of is meat good for you? It's a question of should you be eating as much meat as most Americans do? And the answer is no. So I've tried to adjust my personal cooking and then the way that I talk about and write about cooking to that notion.
The Boston Globe quotes you as saying that back in the 90s, you thought, hey, I'll be successful if I can convince Americans to eat rice and beans once a week. And now that's like many people are. Do me a favor. Let's say I've got rice. Let's say I've got a can of beans. I don't have time to soak, so I've got a can of black beans. How do I take those two things and make it exciting?
By the way, soaking's not necessary, but you should get a pressure cooker.
Okay.
I almost literally eat whole grains and legumes for lunch every day, and they're never the same. You know, beans can kind of be as simple as sort of soupy black beans with cumin and garlic, maybe a little chopped onion, South American, Caribbean style, or you can do dal with an elaborate spice mix and maybe some mustard seeds fried in oil at the end. And often I do things that are simple as beans with garlic and rosemary, lemon and olive oil. You think of a culture, everybody cooks legumes. Legumes are the most important protein source in the world. Honestly, you could probably do 1,000 variations on basic bean recipes. I don't do that. I think there are 20, but that's plenty.
Well, there's almost 1,000 pages in the book, and I just flipped open to 456, and here we are. 16 dishes to serve over couscous, sautéed eggplant with basil, winter squash curry, chickpeas in their own broth, lentils. Here's 8 ways to enhance cooked grains. Just tender cooked vegetables, peas, chopped greens, a couple of spoonfuls of a simple sauce, any flavored oil, compound butter, a vinaigrette. You just pour these ideas out. Dried fruit, you know, put them in your grains. Add sautéed mushrooms. So it's about, you know, having the grains, having the legumes, and then just playing with it a little bit.
Well, pantry is important for sure, because half the things you mentioned keep forever. The three things that go into it are knowing what to do, having the stuff on hand, and then shopping for something fresh and wonderful. The key is really getting good ingredients and not screwing them up.
So pantry's important. Maybe.
Don't do it.
Yeah,
don't
do it. Five things. Five things to have in the pantry.
I was going to say don't put a number on it.
Okay.
I mean, when you start cooking, you need some equipment and you need some stuff in the pantry. I mean, you need olive oil. You need soy sauce. You need vinegar. You need garlic. You need those kinds of things on hand all the time. But since many of those things keep more or less forever, or let's say keep for a year, as you need them, you accumulate them. So you can have 5 or 10 different kinds of dried beans in the pantry at the same time and the same number of grains. And you can have anchovies and capers and dried shrimp and
tuna.
Bonito flakes, right, and tuna. And all of those things, because they just keep. And then you have the option.
You also talk about flexibility. I think you have just spoken of flexibility, but is that what you mean, just being able to have a few things on hand to be flexible?
I mean, there's a joke that some old food writer friends and I have that there are really only 10 recipes in the world. And in a way, it's true. You know, going back to that eggplant example, if you can fry something, you can pretty much fry anything. If you can roast something, you know, once you get these basics down, once you learn how to judge doneness, it's all just kind of playing with the possibilities. My job is to just show people how to do the basics and then give them ideas for the possibilities.
Yeah. I mentioned having a can of tuna on hand. You know, my mother used to throw it in with noodles and suddenly you had a casserole. And something happened along the way where that wasn't good enough. Is that part of what you're saying?
No, because I'm not really a fan of tuna noodle casserole. You know, I think
there are many
legitimate dishes you can make with a can of tuna. I think 1950s tuna noodle casserole is not among them, but other people disagree with
me. You don't prefer a can of mushroom soup and potato chips on
cream
the top?
Of mushroom soup. Oh, well, there you go.
Or crushed corn checks. I guess what I'm saying is that it got away from just mixing things up in a pot and thinking that you had to do something more extravagant.
I'm going to disagree with you here, because when you're mixing canned tuna and cream of mushroom soup and potato chips, for example, you're mixing some things that contain other things, especially the cream of mushroom soup, that you don't really want to be eating to begin with. When you take a piece of fish and stick it under the broiler with olive oil and put lemon on it, you have 3 ingredients.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely in favor of the latter.
You say that we don't talk enough about food and you compare it to the economy and things like that. But it feels like we always talk about food. Are we not talking about food in the right way?
Well, I think we're starting to talk about food in the right way. Food is as important to humans as anything. I mean, that is literally true. You can't say that about too many things. So to talk about our favorite restaurants is not the same thing as to talk about where food comes from and how it's produced. And I think where food comes from and how it's produced is really, really critical. And we are seeing that agriculture has an impact on both climate and also on our diets. We can only eat what we're provided with. We can only eat what's grown. And if what's grown is corn for junk food and for animal feed and for ethanol, well, then we're going to drive cars and eat a lot of junky meat and a lot of junky food. And, you know, there's a better way to do these things. And that should be part of the conversation.
How does it feel to have put this out again?
You know, I remember 20 years ago when this book came out. And of course, I think you talk to many more authors than I do, but I bet they all say similar things, which is that I was convinced this book was going to be a failure. And I was convinced this book was going to be a failure. And lo and behold, it was not. And to have the opportunity to redo it in a way that makes it contemporary, that makes it better, that makes it more relevant, I mean, it's fabulous. I couldn't be happier about it.
Because you've said it's a work of a lifetime to change a bad food habit.
Well, we are doing ourselves a disservice. I mean, I don't want to be too preachy, but you know, until we start raising kids, appreciating what real food is and appreciating where it comes from and how to put it together, we're not going to have generations of adults that aren't hung up on food. Right now, there isn't a person who isn't listening to this, including you and me, who doesn't know how hard it is to change the way they eat because we've all been raised with substandard food habits. And then we grow up and we say, gee, I should be eating less meat. I should be eating more vegetables. I should be eating more. And it's not that easy to change. All I can do is try to make those things easier.
Vegetables to mash with potatoes. It's a whole chart right here.
Was this your plan, was to like ask hard questions and then read
just
recipe
read your
titles?
Book. It's so much fun, Mark Bittman. Oh, my God. A whole page. 9 sweet and savory ways to broil and grill fruit. Mark Bittman, again, 6-time James Beard Award winner, author of 20 cookbooks, including the reboot 20th anniversary edition of How to Cook Everything. Mark, what's your favorite? And I know you're probably going to say you can't do that, but can you? Is there a favorite recipe in here?
Is there a favorite recipe in there? No. Yeah. I mean, I do rice and beans. I'm telling you, that's the key.
That's
the key to life, rice and beans.
There you have it. The key to life for Mark Bittman, rice and beans. And yet the book is the size of a phone book. Remember those? So it's been 20 years since the original How to Cook Everything came out. Have you changed your eating habits since then? What are some of your new favorites? Are you eating more rice and beans? Let us know. HereAndNow.org.
This message comes from NPR sponsor MindBody. MindBody connects millions to the widest variety of local fitness classes, and they offer the same experience when it comes to massage and acupuncture, spas and salons. Find, book, and pay all in one place. Owners can join the network at mindbodyonline.com/NPR. MindBody, your access to the largest consumer wellness network and marketplace.
President Trump's tax returns remain hidden from the view of state prosecutors in New York, despite a federal judge's ruling yesterday that they must be handed over. The Trump administration appealed that decision, and an appeals court agreed to delay the handover. MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi joins us from New York with more on this. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
So just to remind people, unlike previous presidents, President Trump never showed the American people his tax returns, saying he's under audit.
Right.
There are two parallel attempts going on to get them, one from Congress and this one from the Manhattan District Attorney, who's investigating whether Trump broke the law when he made hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal.
Yep.
What did the judge rule yesterday, the one who said he's got to turn them over?
Right. This is about the hush money payments. The judge in the federal district court in Manhattan said that the president's efforts to shield his tax returns from state prosecutors by saying that he's immune to criminal investigation, the judge said, quote, that's repugnant to the nation's governmental structure and constitutional values. The point is that while the president does have, it's not really immunity from being indicted. It's a Department of Justice advisory letter that prevents a president from being indicted. He does not have immunity from investigation. There are many ways that can take place, but the president is claiming they don't have a right to do so. The judge said that's not true.
And then this appeals court ruling came that said, "Well, hold off. You don't have to turn these over yet." What happens now?
So that's expected. If I had a case against you and I got a judgment against you, you could almost always get a stay stay pending an appeal, right? Once it's only once you're through with all appeals that no one will stay a judgment. But basically, the appeals court says it would hear more arguments about this later this month, and the enforcement of the subpoena to get the tax returns would be delayed until then. Now, even if Cyrus Vance, the Manhattan district attorney, gets the tax returns, it doesn't mean that they become public, because there are rules that govern the secrecy of either grand jury investigations or other sorts of investigations. And it's not clear that anything that Donald Trump will have done, as indicated by his tax returns, is in fact a crime. It would have to actually be a falsification of business records to commit to conceal another crime. So yet to know what happens when and if the DA actually gets the tax returns.
You think this will end up before the Supreme Court?
Hard to tell. This one has been dragging out for a long time. In fact, the congressional effort may, in fact, end up before the Supreme Court as well. But that takes a lot of time. Ultimately, Donald Trump has never been able to prove that he's under audit, but he seems to have been successful in fending off these efforts until now.
And this isn't just about the president's tax returns. It's
No.
sort of about the power of the presidency, isn't it?
Yes. In fact, it's very little to do with the tax returns. It's got to do with what the president can decide he or she can disclose, what they're compelled to disclose, and whether or not, if you're investigating misdeeds by the president, either criminal or political, whether you can get these kinds of documents. It's got very little to do with taxes. It'd be interesting to see the president's tax returns, but from an investigative perspective, it's where some of the president's money came from and what authority either Congress or the courts have to figure that out.
It would also give whoever gets to see the tax returns an idea of whether President Trump is really worth as much money as he says he is.
And many people say that might be the motivating factor for President Trump not wanting to see people to see his tax returns.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thanks as always.
My pleasure.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver is dealing with the controversy over a tweet from Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey that supported the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. Morey's tweet was deleted after sparking outrage in mainland China, where the NBA is extremely popular. Morey then wrote that he didn't intend to cause offense. That sparked outrage in the U.S. because it appeared he was being censored. Here's Adam Silver speaking today in Japan.
We are not apologizing for Daryl exercising his freedom of expression. I regret, again, having communicated directly with many friends in China, that so many people are upset, including millions and millions of our fans.
Silver spoke after China's state broadcaster canceled plans to show some preseason games this week. Let's bring in Mike Pesca, host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com and Here Now sports analyst. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So Silver is in Tokyo today for this preseason game between the Rockets and the NBA championship winners, the Toronto Raptors. The NBA clearly in a very tough spot here, though, with China. What do you make of what Silver is saying in the needle he's trying to thread?
What he's saying today is a little different from what he said yesterday and the statement, or I should say statements, he put out yesterday. So yesterday, the NBA issued an official statement that had language including, "We recognize that Daryl Morey's views have deeply offended many in China, which is regrettable." So sort of passive in its construction. But when translated, and the New York Times did a translation and other media sites, even Google Translate had this translation, "We're extremely disappointed in Morey's inappropriate statement." So flat out calling it inappropriate. No doubt he severely hurt the feelings of fans. So with that said, and it was based on not only that statement, but Silver's initial castigation of Daryl Morey's tweets, I, among others, said this is the most shameful episode in Silver's entire career. I can't believe that they're not backing an employee who said, or employee of a team who said, a pretty de minimis statement in terms of the protesters in Hong Kong, who are obviously on the side of democracy as opposed to the side of repression. And then to bring it up to today, I do think he has walked it back a bit, or at least walked back the tone, and the emphasis is today is, even if we're going to to take some flack on this. We're standing with Maury. And that wasn't clear in the past day's statements.
Well, they're in a very unusual position because, of course, it would be totally appropriate in the United States for an American to say we stand with the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. But the NBA, unlike so many other businesses, actually has a lot of business in China, hundreds of millions of viewers.
Well, it's not that unusual given China's international tentacles, given the fact that China is a market of 1.4 billion people where all major multinational corporations want to get into.
And China, want to get into, but the NBA is actually there.
They're there. But, you know, Marriott's there, and Marriott, a low-level employee, favorited a pro-Tibet tweet, and China put pressure on them to fire that employee. Delta had a map that showed the boundaries of Macau and Tibet, and China says they shouldn't have boundaries. They're a part of China, and made Delta change the map. So China has sensitivities that an American, because we do live in the very society of free speech, can't even quite fathom as to how repressive they are. And I'm sure when Daryl Morey put the tweet, if someone asked him, do you think China will like it? He would say, no, but what's it really matter? Well, to China, it matters a lot. And to get, and to give you the bottom line on how much the NBA is into China, $1.5 trillion was what one streaming service paid for the 5-year rights to NBA games. NBA China, which is the branded entity arm of the NBA, is said to be worth $4 billion, according to an NBA source. So you are right. They are way into China, and there's a lot of money on the line.
Well, we'll keep following this story because it seems to develop by the day. Mike Pesca, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the U.S. and China are set to continue trade talks on Thursday ahead of new tariffs on Chinese imports that take effect a week from today. The trade war between the two countries has affected many industries, especially those that have looked to China for growth. That includes the cranberry industry, which was drowning in surplus fruit a few years ago. So they went to China in search of new customers, and they found them. Adrian Ma of WBUR starts our story at a shopping mall in Beijing.
So, can I ask you, do you recognize this fruit right here?
This is some kind of raisin? Let me think.
That's Lu Xiuqin. Looking at some dried cranberries I've just poured into her hand, she takes a bite.
It's a little sour. It's a little sweet. The texture is nice.
Finally, I tell her, it's a cranberry. Or in Chinese, man yue mei. Suddenly, Lu's face changes, and she's like, oh, right. A few years ago, most people here were like Lu, wouldn't know a cranberry if they were looking right at one. In 2013, the cranberry company Ocean Spray asked Chinese consumers if they knew what cranberries were. Over 95% said no, which is a problem, because how do you sell a food to a people who've never heard of it? Well, for any business trying to get a foothold in China's $7 billion imported fruit market, the first step often starts in a place like this. The International Fruit Expo, which took place this year in the sprawling southeastern city of Guangzhou. It feels like an open-air market with stalls from all over the world.
You've got people selling peaches, durian fruit. Ah, okay. Something called a custard apple.
One more box.
There's a lot of excitement happening at this small table right now.
You see, they're fighting for the mangoes.
That's mango merchant Dadu Raman.
We almost sold 216 boxes just in the past 3 days.
Watching Raman and the other merchants here, there's a palpable sense of opportunity. Like, if you can sell into China, it could change your business fortunes in a big way. This is why, over the past few years, the U.S. cranberry industry has spent millions of dollars here to get people to taste, maybe even love, the little red fruit.
At least not get confused with blueberries.
That's Lydia Lee. She heads up the China division of the PR firm Weber Shandwick. In 2013, Ocean Spray, the Microsoft of the cranberry biz, hired the agency to help raise its profile. So Lee's team devised strategies that would become part of the company's China playbook, like pushing the product on giant e-commerce sites, wining and dining editors from food and lifestyle publications, and even flying social media influencers out to a Massachusetts bog to see a cranberry harvest in person.
So these influencers brought their own cameras and live streamed the whole process.
This video shows a young woman wading through the water, waist deep in cranberries.
And these followers, you know, they were tweeting all about it because it's something very curious.
Curious maybe, but to really up a product's appeal, Lee says you need to create an emotional connection. On that score, they played up the cranberries' connection to Thanksgiving. In this ad, a young Chinese woman joins an American family for Thanksgiving dinner.
The whole atmosphere of family gathering together, you know, having a feast, watching football, kids running around, resonates very well with Chinese culture. This is what we do in Chinese New Year. Instead of just waiting for Chinese New Year, how about having an early thanks?
In addition to Ocean Spray, there was another group trying to promote cranberries in China, a quasi-governmental nonprofit called the Cranberry Marketing Committee. Since 2014, the group has spent roughly $1 million a year just marketing in China. In the past, some of that money has gone to paying restaurants to put cranberry-themed dishes on the menu, or hiring fancy chefs to create recipes. After years of this multi-front marketing blitz, the cranberry market has finally taken root here. Between 2013 and 2018, sales of dried cranberries to China increased by over 1,000%. Last year, China bought nearly $55 million worth of the fruit, making it the biggest U.S. cranberry customer. Except that's not the end of the story. That's because of a little thing that began in the summer of 2018.
The White House is planning to release the list of products from China that will face a 25% tariff.
Tariffs for around $50 billion worth of goods still don't know.
The Trump administration said that tariffs are, quote, essential to preventing.
Immediately, China hit back with retaliatory tariffs, including a 40% import tax on cranberries. And that tariff has put the squeeze on what was the industry's fastest growing market. For Here and Now, I'm Adrian Ma.
And Adrian's report was made possible in part by the International Center for Journalists, bringing home the World Fellowship. This is Here and Now.
And a few minutes now on a tender topic, suicide. And we hope that if anyone listening has the need for it, they will call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which is 1-800-273-8255 or 1-800-273-TALK, which is an easier way to remember it, but not easy enough. Which is why the Federal Communications Commission has come up with a proposal for a new three-digit number. We want to find out more about that with Dr. John Draper. He's director of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And Dr. Draper, before we go to the new proposal, what happens now when you call 1-800-273-TALK?
What happens when you call the current 800-273-8255 number is we just link you to the nearest local crisis center in the national network. The Lifeline is made up of over 170 local centers across the United States. We try to connect the caller to the center nearest to them, and if they're not available, the call rolls over to a backup center to make sure that all calls are answered.
And who do they talk to? Who's on the other end?
For all of our accredited call centers, all of them have counselors who've been trained to listen, assess the nature and severity of the issue, listen to the person's problem, and work with them to get the best and most appropriate care for them to keep them safe. And also to get them additional treatment if they need it.
Yeah, well, we know suicides are going up in the U.S. despite a global decline. According to the Centers for Disease Control, 47,000 people died by their own hand in 2017. And the number of calls are going up as well. It's predicted you'll get 2.5 million by the end of this year. Do you know that you'd get more? I mean, is there a sense that people can't remember that number when they need it?
Well, here's what we do know. There's about a little over 13 million people in the United States who think seriously about suicide throughout the United States. And that's every year. And we think that if we're reaching about 2.5 million callers, that we have a lot more that we're missing. Mm. But what we know is that when you have a number that's only three digits, if you're in a crisis state, it's really often hard to remember. It's hard to dial. So if you give somebody less to remember and less to dial, it's just going to make things easier. We call that creating cognitive access for people who are in crisis states.
And the three digits that are being proposed are 988. But do you worry that, you know, by some estimates, they say it could be double the calls in the first year of a three-digit number. Do you worry that the centers will be overwhelmed?
Well, right now, our centers are needing additional resources. So that's certainly a concern, that as calls go up, you want to make sure that there's people who are available to answer those calls. And that is already being discussed as part of this initiative. It's not just opening the doors wide open and come one, come all. It's got to be done thoughtfully with the right infrastructure in place. So I don't think any discussions are occurring about having this three-digit number independent of, well, we should also be providing resources to all the local crisis centers that are answering these calls.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a part of that conversation.
Although some people are saying, in fact, a three-digit number instead of a 10-digit could actually be cost-effective because, you know, you hate to talk about dollars and cents, but in fact, it might stop emergency room visits, ambulances, other services when somebody can't get help, if they can get help through a three-digit number. Do you see a downside?
I really don't. What we're doing is saying, how do we make it easier for people to get help whose life could be in danger? To your point, there's downsides if we don't do it. I mean, to the extent that right now 911 calls are rife with quite a number of mental health emergencies. And one of the things that, I thought my daughter said it best, my daughter is a 19-year-old freshman in college, and she also has a history of anxiety and depression. I asked her what she thought about this three-digit number idea, and she said, I think it's going to do more than anything to erase the stigma against mental illness here in the United States. And I said, well, why is that? And she said, well, we have a three-digit number for medical emergencies. Dad, if we had one for psychological emergencies, people would know that they're real, and they would know that when you dialed this three-digit number that you got a different kind of help than cops or an ambulance coming to your door, that you actually got the voices of people who are caring and wanted to help you in the moment. And not in any way to disparage law enforcement or what happens with technicians who drive ambulances, but unquestionably a different response is required. And I think part of the reason, perhaps, that people aren't calling the lifeline to the extent they could be is because they're afraid of that kind of response.
Yeah. Dr. John Draper, director of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, and remember again, their number is 1-800-273-TALK or 273-8255, but hoping soon to change it to a three-digit number. There will be a time of public comment, and so people will be able to weigh in. Dr. Draper, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate it.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.